The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.
Well, now I'm joined by Sinead Burke, founder and CEO of Tilting the Lens, a disability advocate, and she's going to discuss living in Ireland and the systemic issues we need to address, along with her own plans for 2025. Sinead, good morning and welcome. It's been a while.
It's been a while. Good morning, Pat. Thanks so
you
much for having me.
You were only beginning your life's journey when we first met.
Yeah.
And now look at you.
Well, it's been a while. So thank you so much for having me on the show.
Let's go back in time. You grew up as a so-called, the term is little person.
Yeah.
And your dad also was a little person, but not the rest of your family.
Yeah, I'm one of five. I have three sisters and a brother. Amazing people. My sister actually just had a baby yesterday. So the family is growing in lots of different ways. And my parents are two extraordinary advocates in and of themselves. My mum, Kath, my dad, Chris. And my father's a little person. We have dwarfism. So the most common form of dwarfism, achondroplasia. I think language can often be challenging and nuanced for people. Some people prefer the term dwarf or having dwarfism. I often describe myself as being a little person. And I think growing up, you know, 80% of little people are born to two average height parents and two non-disabled parents, in the sense that they are often the only one like them within that family unit. And I think for me, growing up, having the privilege of my dad and that representation and such proximity to that representation made so many things easier for me, because he had already had that lived experience, had those questions.
Did he have a battle in the way that perhaps you didn't, because he was a trailblazer for you?
In different ways. I think he grew up in a different era. My dad grew up in Birmingham in the UK. And in some ways, there was probably more advanced policies in the UK at the time. But also, we didn't have the same sense of connection, the same sense of medical information or education. So he absolutely paved a way. And then for me, also being a young woman, there was different questions that needed to be answered, whether that was something as simple as clothes and school uniforms, but also just the idea that, you know, I was born in 1990. So I also grew up in a different world where, yes, there was some more supports, but there was also other systemic challenges that were in place.
Now, presumably at home, and I know you've become a homeowner yourself,
yes,
and you've kind of created a home that is literally perfect for you. But in your own home with sisters who were not like you and a mother who's not like you, did your father make sure that home was designed for you too?
I think the wonderful thing about even my work today is very much rooted in the principles of universal design and inclusive design, which is often frameworks to try to make design as comfortable as everyone. And maybe just a couple of minutes before we came on air, you and I were trying to manipulate.
We're struggling with the chair here.
With the studio chairs.
You wanted to bring it down. I have never had to bring it down. I've had to bring it up.
Right.
For me, but not down.
So I think when we think about designing our environments, right, and whether that is a policy or whether that is a home, it's about how do you find as many different solutions as possible that work for everyone? And our house growing up was an example of that, right? It wouldn't have worked for us for everything to be designed for my dad and I. That would have created a disabling experience for the rest
of
my
family. Can't have a switch that's only 18 inches off the floor to switch on the lights, because everyone has to bend down.
Exactly. So finding something in the middle. So some of the light switches, all of the light switches were lower, and they were lowered in a way that was accessible for my dad and I. But
you reached up and they reached slightly down.
It didn't create a burden on anyone. But then at the same time, when there were challenges where the environment was physically inaccessible, we made do with footstools or different technologies, even thinking about something like having a Google Home or an Alexa in your house can create accessibility. So our home also evolved as technology did, as assistive technology did, but it was constantly working with that tension of what's accessible for one, what's accessible for another.
Your parents, for you, put no barriers in your way. They didn't say there were things that you could never aspire to.
No.
Now, clearly, there might be some things like playing basketball would not be high on your list of priorities.
Depends where you play basketball, Pat. If I go to the World Dwarf Games or the Paralympics, I could be an excellent basketball player. But it's exactly that. You know, for me, my parents very much built my childhood with the understanding of the social model and the rights-based model of disability. So what I mean by that is the social model looks at disability as a way in which it is our environments that create the disabling impact and experience, in the sense that, you know, if you were to live in my world, you would experience disability in the sense of a world designed specifically for me. And my parents always gave me the understanding that design could be changed, whether that was the design of a mindset, a behavior, or the design of a radio studio. Those things could be changed to create access. And my parents always gave me the understanding that what made me different, how I saw the world, how I experienced it, was an added value. It wasn't something that made me less of a person. It wasn't something that made me a burden to society. It was creativity. And I believe that lived experience is intellectual property. And they saw a value in that, in me chasing whatever academic or professional dreams that I wanted.
Now, the most unlikely area that you might have selected for someone who's a little person who has dwarfism, to give it a semi-technical term, would be fashion, where they're all long and skinny.
And that
would be the last thing I would have thought, but that's when we first met. That's exactly what you wanted to do.
What I wanted to do as regards to fashion, you know, my background is that I'm an educator and a teacher by training. I then have a master's in broadcast production for TV and radio, and found it difficult to get jobs in both of those arenas, though I really enjoyed them and think that those skills are still very much my day-to-day practice as a business owner and as an entrepreneur. And for me, my interest in fashion was never about being a model. I could absolutely see the
stereotype image of fashion is precisely that.
And still is, right? Fashion is an industry, particularly if you look to the luxury aspect of the market, where thinness, where whiteness, where there is always a bias in terms of what is beautiful. And we have to continue to change that. My interest in fashion came about in the system and the business. I'm really trying to activate change at all levels, particularly when we think about who gets to be a designer, right? We have some amazing designers, fashion designers that have come here from Ireland and don't necessarily have the ecosystem to grow their business. But then if we think about intersectionality and the ways in which identities overlap, challenges can occur based on those identities and access and lack of income. One of the things that I really wanted to do with Tilting the Lens was create a very specific pipeline of talent for disabled designers. So we've created a scholarship at Parsons School of Design in New York, where we currently have 5 disabled people training to be fashion designers, because fashion is a microcosm of lots of other industries. We can rely on visibility and representation for systemic change. The reality is, whilst that is effective, it sometimes takes too long, and it can also transform and change with trends. So if we think about creating pathways for careers, opportunities, and for leadership, there is a greater likelihood that that innovation is valued and people can thrive.
Now, you yourself, you were a cover girl.
Yes.
You had to do the photo shoot and so on. And you brought what the term I don't really like, but you brought the learnings from that.
Yes.
To bear so that things might change.
So I was fortunate to be asked to be part of the September issue of British Vogue in 2019. And it was the Forces for Change issue. There was a number of extraordinary people on the cover. I was the first little person to feature on the cover of Vogue. And while I'm very proud of that, the reality is 2019 is still a very long time when the first is still happening. And I have a huge amount of privileges in the identities that I hold. But even when I got to set that day, while it was a really wonderful and, you know, experience I never could have predicted.
A welcoming experience?
It was inaccessible in so many ways, just due to the fact that having not had the legacy of disabled people being in those rooms, there wasn't necessarily the readiness for it. And I remember leaving that set that day thinking, this has to be a way for more disabled people to access this industry, to access this moment, but also they shouldn't be expected to do the emotional labor or the work in order to be safe and at ease there. So I set up Tilting the Lens in 2020, which is a consultancy across Europe with a global footprint where we hire disabled and non-disabled people. And we were asked in 2023 by British Vogue to come in as the consulting partners to make that issue the most representative of disability to date and also the most accessible. And one of the things that I'm really proud of is there was 5 covers, 5 disabled people, 19 disabled people inside. The articles were written by disabled writers and journalists. But even just thinking about how different people access the magazine, one of the things that we really wanted to do was make it available in Braille. Yeah. And, you know, January 4th was World Braille Day. And I remember us having the conversation with Vogue about making it available in Braille. And they said, does anybody blind read Vogue? And I said, well, why don't we discover if they do, if they wish to, if they want to?
And the problem, I suppose, Vogue would be thinking, we are primarily pictorial.
Yeah.
Where, you know, if you don't have the photographs, there's no Vogue. That's what they'd be thinking. And therefore they'd say, why would a blind person want to read Vogue?
And I think it's such an interesting question with what is happening in the world as regards to accessibility in general currently. So June 28th, 2025 is a big date within the accessibility and disability communities, because that is when the European Accessibility Act is coming into fruition. So it is going to have a huge impact here in Ireland, but across the member states in Europe for anybody who is delivering products or services into the EU.
Practically, what will it mean?
So even if we think about, to your point around Vogue, so if we think about access to digital experiences, but also access to visual experiences. So even thinking about your program, Pat, the next time you upload an image onto Instagram or a video, are you making sure that that content is accessible? So if we take Instagram as a platform, before uploading that to the grid and to the feed, you need to go into advanced options. And within that, scroll to the bottom where it offers you the opportunity to write alt text. Alt text stands for alternative text. So if you're a person who's blind and low vision, or if you're somebody who uses assistive technology like a screen reader, if that text-based information is not given to describe the image, that person has no access to the visual content, which means currently around 80% of the internet is inaccessible to people who are blind and low vision or use assistive tech. So while we can talk about the big picture of Vogue being made available in Braille and multiple formats, the reality is, with new legislation coming down the tracks, but also just for societal inclusion, we have more opportunity than ever, and now a mandate, to make even something as simple as content accessible.
I'm not sure you want to name drop, but your list of clients is pretty impressive.
We've been fortunate, and we're in existence for 4 years, you know, and as a disability-led business and as a disabled founder, I'm so proud of what we've been able to achieve in 4 years across multiple countries. I think primarily the thing that I am most proud of is creating an environment internally within our own company where disabled people can thrive. I think about the policies and practices that we've been able to put in place for sick leave, for parental leave, making sure that flexibility is valued. But I think about some of the projects that we've been able to do globally, whether that is working with public jobs here in Ireland and supporting them with the reasonable accommodations process in order to meaningfully employ disabled people in the public and civil sector, or thinking about working with businesses that are worth billions of dollars to support them with designing new stores, designing their office spaces, and really even moving out of just fashion. So we did a considerable project last year around the banking sector here in Ireland, particularly linked to the European Accessibility Act. You know, when we think about the rights of disabled people, having the right to be able to understand or access your bank statement, having the right to be able to access an ATM machine, having the right to understand so much of what
exists. Straight away, I'm thinking of ATM machine. You've got to be minimum 5'2", 3" to use the keyboard.
And part of what we do within our company is we center the expertise of disabled people. So we have done surveys, workshops, focus groups with disabled people centered to really create the solutions. One of the big aha moments for me, Pat, as a disabled person that I didn't know about myself, and I work on the principle that we don't know what we don't know, we engage with a whole cohort of deaf people who share that when they go into the bank, if they're engaging with a teller, often the glass screen that is there to protect both parties, there can be a glare from the lights overhead, which interrupts lip reading. Pat, I have never had to think about that because that's not my lived experience. But being able to then bring that to the sector and say, this is an immediate change that could create all sorts of access for as many different people as possible.
I mean, you're making the point very clearly, because when you describe yourself as disabled and identify with the disabled community, I see you as one of the most able people I've ever come across. So it's your environment that renders you disabled, not nothing inherent about yourself.
I think in Ireland, we have had such a history where to be disabled often equated as something negative. I think even in how our language has evolved, there has been, I think, a reluctance for people to even say the term or the word disabled because they feel that that has a discomfort to it or is a negative to somebody else. For me, I'm very proudly disabled. Being a disabled person doesn't make me less of a person. It makes me who I am. I don't use euphemisms such as special needs or differently abled. I often think when people say to me, you know, you have lots of abilities, Sinead. It's true, but as does everybody. But that doesn't minimize the fact that I am disabled. It also, for me, being a disabled person is really valuable and really important. And I love the community that I'm part of. And I think the other thing that we should all be mindful of is, you know, when we think about the changing demographics here in Ireland, it is most likely that we are all going to be disabled at some point in our lives. And when I say that, some of the listeners will probably have, you know, hair standing up at the back of their necks a pang in their chest, because often it feels like something negative, whereas I see it as an invitation, a welcome. We look at our aging society. We look at the number of people. You know, most recent data says 1 in 10 people are neurodivergent, also a cohort of the disabled community. We look at the impact of mental health, depression, anxiety, also a cohort of the disabled community. This isn't a small group of people over there. This is all of us at any time.
2025, an important date, as you mentioned, in June. But tell me about your own ambitions for 2025. You're so busy. You're doing so many things.
Thank
so
you.
Successfully.
Well, my big goals this year are very much in continuing to grow the business. We have just had a number of weeks of planning of the business strategy. So looking to 7-9% year-on-year growth and continuing our profit margin without external investment and capital. But I think very personally, you know, to that point, the European Accessibility Act is coming to fruition in June. I think also something to look out for is the Corporate Social Responsibility Directive, which is the CSRD. So again, this is going to impact Irish companies. You know, to date, only the public sector has had a mandate about the recruitment of disabled people. But what we're going to see in 2026 is companies that have more than 250 employees will have to externally communicate the number of disabled people that is part of their workforce. And that's going to have an impact in several ways. So just measuring that is not enough, because you have to create the psychological safety for people to say yes, but it will also impact where disabled talent navigate to. And I think that's exciting.
Finally, and briefly, as we approach 11 o'clock, the idea of doing your own home and
yes.
how in that environment you do not feel disabled.
No.
What sort of things did you do?
Well, you should visit, Pat. So I have the most beautiful kitchen that is 60 centimetres in height. That is a seamless experience for me. You know, I think when I was living at home with my parents, and I was fortunate to do so, like many people in this country, till almost my mid-30s, I didn't like cooking. I didn't think it was something I could do. And to have the freedom and the safety to be able to work with pots and things and, you know, have it close to the kitchen, I've really enjoyed the mindfulness of cooking. I have things like electric blinds so that I don't have to reach constantly. I have just a thoughtfulness to the design that, you know, it is for me, and creating as much of a frictionless experience, because, you know, there is nothing greater, and again said with huge amounts of privilege, of closing the door to an inaccessible world and being able to just take a deep breath, to not have to ask for help, though sometimes that's still the case, and just to be able to be is a gift.
And if we could design the world in this way, it would make life a lot easier for many people with disabilities.
And I think it's for everyone. You know, I think when we think about accessibility and design, you know, things that I often hear is it's very expensive. It creates a burden on those who are non-disabled. And I think, you know, there are, of course, cost challenges if we're looking to older buildings, when retrofitting can be a challenge. But as we think about new buildings, new design, I think we need to move our mindset from compliance. There are some great building regulations and standards here that support accessibility, but the reality is they should be the floor, not the ceiling. It is not enough.
Sinead Burke, what an inspiration. Thank you very much for joining us in studio. The Pat Kenny Show with Aviva Insurance. Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.